Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm the host and leader of this ragtag bunch, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me is Master Swordsman, Mr. Gabe Haggard.
Fascinating. I'm not bored at all, I swear.
And today's very special guest is eager young apprentice, Mr. Derek Kessler.
Hello. Konnichiwa.
While Derek may be new to the ways of the warrior, he's actually very well versed in Japanese culture. He speaks fluent Japanese. He lived in Japan for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And actually works as a translator for a Japanese company.
That's correct.
All right. So that background should prove useful, because today's Sight and Sound entry, the 17th greatest movie of all time, is Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Listen up to see if our little clan feels the movie is worthy of such an honor. We're going to follow that up with a discussion about movies as entertainment. Should the primary goal of a movie be to entertain its audience, or should its aims be a little higher? We're going to fight about it and hopefully come to some amicable agreement. Or maybe this podcast will end in bloodshed. We shall see.
I brought my sword. I hope you guys did too.
Then to help us heal our battle wounds, we're going to end the show with a few final notes of positivity. You guys ready?
Let's do it.
All right. Let them in.
Just one at a time, then.
One at a time. One at a time. For our first topic, we're going to discuss Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Released in 1954 to global acclaim, this sprawling 3.5-hour-long period action movie was actually Kurosawa's first foray into samurai films, a genre that for many would come to define Kurosawa's career, though it should be said that many people prefer his non-period work. Seven Samurai tells the story of a group of poor, defenseless farmers who become aware that their homes and livelihoods will soon be under siege by a band of ruthless bandits. In order to protect what is theirs, the farmers recruit seven ronin, or masterless samurai, to help fortify their land and lead the farmers in battle. All right, so that's the basic premise. So let's get started. What do you guys think of the movie? Gabe, let's start with you.
I really like this movie.
Okay.
It's really long.
Yes.
And I wondered if the intermission is included in the total runtime of this film, or if that can be taken out. And if it really is 3 hours and 37 minutes, or if it's, you know, 3 hours and 30 minutes, a mere 3 hours and 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a very enjoyable movie. And I think it encompasses so much of what filmmaking is. It has so many different facets to it. It's really enjoyable to watch.
Yeah. Derek, how about you?
I agree with Gabe, and I've loved this movie for a very long time, actually. As you mentioned, I did live in Japan, but even before I got into studying Japanese culture, for some reason this movie appealed to me very much. I saw it once. I caught it on TV when I was maybe 12 or something. I don't think I understood all of the elements, the film elements that were going on, but I still enjoyed the movie very much for some reason. Something engaged me in the movie. And rewatching it recently, I still like it. So as Gabe mentioned, it's almost a half hour per samurai. You know, this is like 3.5-hour movie. It's a long movie, and it's a foreign movie, which tend to feel longer if you're not a native speaker of the language. But even despite that, I find it enjoyable all the way throughout.
Yeah, it's very... Its themes are very universal,
mm-hmm.
and so that is one of the reasons why it can be enjoyed by, you know, the entire world, because the themes that it deals with, that it touches on, the emotions that it brings up are extremely universal and sort of speak to all of us.
I agree completely. This movie seems to have a little bit of everything. It's got romance, it's got adventure, it's got action, it's got cool sword fighting. And as a former guest on this show, Emma Gerard, we were chatting about the movie, and she also mentioned it's got Toshiro Mifune for the ladies. So again, a little bit of everything.
Well, yeah, and even with the action, I'm not sure quite historically in filmmaking whether or not it was revolutionary.
I mean, there is such a wide breadth of different shots used in this movie, and that really is highlighted in those battle scenes. I think in prior samurai films, in other Japanese films prior to Kurosawa, it was more like kabuki, where it was more the fighting was more like a dance. But this like really brought that action. It felt real. It felt like you were there. Really puts the audience right in the middle of that mud and the muck, and it's totally harrowing and exciting. And I also love how the film doesn't shy away from the violence. We see death and it's brutal, and we see the full consequences of all the characters' actions, and even the death of the bandits. I mean, it's still really painful to watch. Did you guys have any takeaway about the violence?
Yeah, I really liked the way that it depicted the battle scenes and violence. You know, it didn't shy away from it, but like you find in a lot of modern films, it wasn't glorifying it or you know, depicting it, showing violence for the sake of violence. It was all wrapped up in the larger story that it was telling, you know, which is a story about, you know, these samurai, these what have fallen or leaderless, masterless samurai defending this village. And the violence served the greater story, and I thought it was very, very effective.
Mm-hmm. Derek, how about you?
Yeah, I agree. The action, it's not like a typical action movie nowadays. It starts off, you know, action movies start with a bang and they continue action throughout the movie. And this movie, it's kind of like it's only bringing you the action when it needs to be done. The first hour and a half of the movie before the intermission, I think there's very little or even no action at all. And
there's one death, but
there's a death, but there's very, very little action.
That was a very boring sword fight.
Very one-sided.
But it's a build-up, and the desperation builds up towards the climax of the movie, and you're kind of expecting this action to come, and you're waiting for it. When the bandits die, or when you know, the townsfolk die, it's kind of like they don't get emotional about it. They don't let the emotions get the best of them. It's kind of like that happened and we have to accept it and let's move on. And it was a part of life. And that's something there's something very Japanese about that, I think. And so, yeah, I think that's represented very well.
Yeah, I think that it's important to note the samurai seem very level-headed throughout. Mm-hmm. But Toshiro Mifune's character, who is notably not an actual samurai, and all the villagers, they are less level-headed. They are very, very emotional throughout. They're always shown crying. Mifune is obviously screaming his head off, crying, laughing. So that, like, the distinctions are very clearly drawn. But Derek, I wanted to ask you, the film takes place during the 16th century mm-hmm. in Japan. So I thought maybe you could maybe give us a little bit more context about mm-hmm. the time period.
Yeah. Not to get too into it, but Japan, typically the history is divided into periods of where the power was centralized. So you have like the Heian period, which is before 1000 AD, where the power was centralized in Kyoto, and then the power moved to different parts of the country, one being Kamakura, and then there was a period around the 1400s when the central government collapsed and power was divided up into all around the country. There were rulers called daimyo that were above samurai in the caste system, and they were basically rulers of land. And they it wasn't until you had a Tokugawa Ieyasu come in mid-17th century, I believe, and he became the first shogun. And up until the shogunate was formed, you just had these this period of war for about 100 years when just clans were battling each other, and it took time for power to consolidate. So, so this takes place right in the middle of that period, and there's a very, very strong class system dividing peasants and samurai and then the daimyo above the samurai. So at that time, the your class was basically determined, I mean, it determined the way you dressed, it determined the way you acted, it determined the way you spoke. That had, it basically determined your life. So watching this movie, as a Westerner, you can very clearly see the line that is drawn between the two classes and the respect, how much respect one class deserves from the other.
I mean, the peasants are shown constantly kowtowing to the samurai. We see it, I think, Derek, you mentioned, in the clothing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot is made of the hair, the different hairstyles.
Yeah, well, samurai had a very distinct hairstyle, which only samurai would wear.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to show that they were a samurai.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a one element that you see in this movie, too.
Yeah, and I mean, we see the leader shaves his head to so he can
pose as a monk.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of symbols of you know, social hierarchy on display that I'm sure we're missing a lot of them as Westerners. But despite that, this movie remains so popular amongst Americans, people, Westerners in general. People love this movie, and I'm wondering why this movie, more so than, say, Ozu's films or any other Japanese filmmaker, why his films endure and are so popular in America.
Well, I think it may have a little bit to do with the fact that what Kurosawa seems to be advocating is a type of democracy and equality of the people, and he sort of wants to bring a close to this complete stratification, and that is something that resonates very strongly with American culture, as to be something that we feel everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
And Kurosawa seems to be advocating that in this film. Now, he's not, you know, advocating it in some, you know, haphazard way, and there still is a tremendous amount of respect given to the samurai class. And so he's, you know, sort of saying equality and justice is important, but it needs to be done in an ordered and, you know, dignified, respectable way.
I want to actually get back to that subject, because I think I might disagree slightly that that's what Kurosawa is advocating, or there might be some question about. I'm still undecided. But Derek, why, you mentioned you saw this as a 12-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. What do you think appealed to you at the time?
Yeah, well, I was trying to figure that out, and what I came up with was, I think one reason why this is so popular in America and in the West is because it's a very, very simple story. The good and the evil are very, very clearly defined. It's black and white, and a lot of Japanese films and even now with anime and manga, what is evil and what is good is very, very loosely defined, and there's a lot of gray area. Even among most of Kurosawa's other films, like Rashomon and Ikiru, it's not clear who the enemy is and who the good, you know, what side represents good. And Americans like things to be clear-cut, whether it's a subconscious thing, and it's not everyone. I mean, there are people who don't like it like that, but I think overall people do like something that's easy to understand, and this is his simplest movie. He's a genius director, and so and the dialogue is great, and the action is superb, and I mean, everything about it, it's got all the great elements of a film, and that's why it's a great movie, but it's so accepted by the West because anyone can watch it. And even if they don't understand what's going on under, you know, under the hood, it's a very simple story to follow. And as a 12-year-old, I followed it easily. You know, I didn't speak Japanese. I didn't know what was going on film-wise, but I just knew I liked it, and I knew I wanted the good guys to win.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, part of it, too, I think, is that the style of filmmaking seems very heavily influenced by Hollywood, by the Hollywood aesthetic. It seems like it could be shot as a classical Hollywood film. I mean, it's D.W. Griffith, the shot selection. So I think that may account for some of its popularity. And also, I think the fact that it is Japanese can give, I feel like there's this exoticism going on.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing I was going to mention. There is a fascination with the exoticism of Japan. And there's a romanticization of samurai and ninja, you know, within our culture. And we try to play off that so much of our media is influenced by, you know, samurai this and ninja that. But this is like the real deal. You know, this is a real, based on actually a true story that Kurosawa came up with in his research when he decided he wanted to do a samurai film. So the backdrop is completely real. The actors are all veteran Japanese actors. The director is Japanese. So this is like the way the Japanese would represent their samurai and the way they want them to be romanticized. And there's something very, very fascinating about that appeals to Westerners.
Yeah. Gabe, I want to get back to your comment about how the themes are universal and how Kurosawa seems to be advocating some form of democracy. I wonder, is that primarily your takeaway from the movie? Like, that's essentially what it was about?
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know if I wanted to state it that strongly.
Yeah.
But it did seem to be sort of what was happening in the film. That it looked to me like the film was taking place when there is a bit of a disturbance in the hierarchy, or at least in the film. There seems to be a bit of a disturbance where you have all these samurai, and there seemed to be an abundance of them in the film.
Right.
Like they're in the town that they're in, they're crawling all over the place. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to be saying that they're that system is deteriorating.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the peasants who throughout the film are continually encouraged to, you know, to rise up, you know, to you know, pull themselves up and to stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the bandits that I felt are a depiction perhaps of what would happen if the peasants rose up without any understanding or any learning or any
order.
any order. And then the samurai come in, and these samurai, which are behaving a little differently than normal samurai might. Many of the samurai are just, you know, don't even touch me, don't even, you know, get very upset. But these seven samurai agree to come and to use their knowledge and their integrity and everything to help the peasants.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to be advocating, like, look, equality is great, and the old caste system should have been thrown off, but let's not do this recklessly. You know, there is a lot of value and a lot of importance to what the samurai are and what they stand for.
Hmm. Derek, what do you think? What did the film mean to you? I guess, and I imagine it's probably changed since you first saw the film, but as an adult, what does the movie mean to you?
Well, what Gabe mentioned is interesting. I never really looked that into it, and now that he mentions that, it's certainly possible that that could be one of the things that Kurosawa was trying to say. But to me, it represents teamwork and working together towards a common goal. And as you mentioned, it's a simple concept, but it's executed so well and so universally. It's just about overcoming despair and despite dismal odds and working together towards that goal. That was what I took away from it when I was 12, and even watching it now, that's still what I feel. And the ending of the movie is very bittersweet. It's not a happy, you know, completely happy ending. It's not a sad ending. I mean, the bad guys don't win, so to speak, but it doesn't, it's not a satisfy all ending. And so that kind of makes me curious, the way it ends might be giving rise to something like what Gabe said, like, well, you know, just, you know, being a samurai isn't going to solve all your problems, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some merit to what Gabe is saying. It's possible.
Yeah.
I think you're totally right about the, you know, the simplicity of it and the things that it's advocating and you know, that are depicted there.
Yeah. I'm not so sure that it's that simple. I do feel like Kurosawa does add some shades of gray, especially when he's talking about how, you know, he's very, very honest about how farmers would scavenge from dead samurai. They might even kill wandering samurai if the opportunity came. They'd certainly take advantage where they could. And it's very brutal. It's very frank in the ways that this disparity between the castes leads to resentment between the samurai and the farmers. And while it states, I think, pretty plainly that were the samurai desperate enough or were the farmers desperate enough, they too might steal from someone. And they have, in fact, stolen. Throughout the film, Kurosawa does seem to be advocating for some kind of collectivism, that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, if you will. Mm-hmm. Derek's my Star Trek buddy.
I don't know. I didn't think that was going to come up during this podcast.
But at the ending, I feel like sort of puts a damper on that notion, because while the farmers come away from it okay, they seem pretty eager to get rid of the samurai. They no longer have use for the samurai. So the samurai are still left wandering, still left without purpose. And indeed, the samurai take heavy losses. So what is the purpose of the samurai? What is their new goal? What is their destiny?
What I think that is a nod to is the fact that the historical realism of what was currently happening, and it wasn't any like revisionist history. They didn't say, and then these samurai ended the class system and now everything is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a wonderful democracy.
And I do agree with you, Gabe. It is this, like, for this brief moment, we could all come together. And that's, I think, that is the power of the film. But let's talk about some cool stuff. This movie's got some cool stuff. What's your favorite character, Gabe?
I don't know that I had, like, a single character. One that was perhaps the most diverting was the crazy one. With his sword, like, 3 times bigger than anyone else's sword, and all his like crazy antics.
Yeah,
and I also did like the leader. I loved the way he rubbed his head whenever he was pondering. But yeah, I don't know that one specific character really stood out.
Yeah,
I mean the one like badass samurai. Mm-hmm. He was awesome. Mm-hmm. He was cool, stone cold killer, and like a Zen philosopher.
Kyozo?
Kyuzo, yeah, Kyuzo, which he's my favorite.
He's pretty cool.
Yeah, I watched it when I was 12, and I liked him, and I watched it again, and I still liked him, so pretty adamant about that. He, I think, represents what a samurai should represent. He's humble, but skilled, and he's level-headed, but he's selfless. I think he upholds all of the things that a samurai should, and even though he's not the leader, and he doesn't try to masquerade as the leader, he's just there, and when he's needed, when he knows he's needed, he just acts. And a great example is that one scene when they're like, "We need a gun," and he's just like, "I got it." And he doesn't even wait for rebuttal. He doesn't give them a chance to say, "No, mate, wait, maybe someone else." He just starts running. You know, he's gone. And he comes back without even a word of... and he's just like, "Now I'll get some rest," you know. And that is just... I think to Westerners, that's just so cool because we don't have that. I don't really see an equivalent in Western culture.
That's exactly what I thought as well, that we don't see, even within filmmaking, we don't see characters like that.
Right.
The character like that, that when I first saw him, what immediately comes to mind is, okay, he's going to be the character that doesn't care. You know, he's going to be the aloof character. Mm-hmm. He's going to be there. He's there, and maybe through the course of the film, he'll learn to care a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he's just in it for the rice balls. He doesn't need any, you know, he's not in it for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But then as these various facets of his character came to light, he becomes so awesome. You know, that he's such a cool character.
Yeah, I think he upholds that ideal for what a samurai should be. And that was always very, very, very attractive to me. Yeah. So,
and I think he represents it all the way to the very end, because one of the aspects of the samurai is the willingness at a moment's notice to die.
Yeah.
And so I think it was very appropriate to the film and the authenticity of the film that he die in the end.
Yeah.
That he is the embodiment, you know, the personification of what it means to be a samurai.
And he dies by gunshot,
yes,
not by sword.
Which
is
interesting.
Not cut down.
And if you notice with his last ounce of strength, he throws his sword into the mud. You know, guns were just recently introduced in Japan in the mid 16th century. And as this takes place towards the end of the 16th century, I always thought that him throwing his sword was a way of saying times have changed. And all of the skill that I did, all of the practice and everything, it means nothing now. Because you can be shot by someone. And I think I always thought that him throwing the sword at the end was him referencing that.
Mm.
Like the end of an era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I like that.
Pauline, how about your favorite character?
My favorite character? Well, for me, it was obviously everyone we mentioned, they're all pretty terrific. But I also love the dynamic between the characters and how Kurosawa establishes sub-dynamics within the group of samurai. Mm. So, you know, Kyozo and the young guy have this relationship.
Right.
And Mifune's character has a relationship with, what's it, Yohei?
Yohei.
Mm-hmm. I loved that.
The old farmer.
The old, yeah.
Gotta love that guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was probably my favorite character.
Yeah.
I think Mifune's like such a revelation. He's mm-hmm. like, there's so much physicality in that mm-hmm. performance, every gesture, every movement. Like, mm-hmm. he seems to just throw his whole body into mm-hmm. it. And that's not something we see. It could have been way over the top, but I think it works really well for that character.
It's
borderline over the top. But actually, interestingly, originally it was going to be about six samurai, not seven.
Right.
And Kurosawa added the seventh character, which was Mifune's character. He wanted to have one zany character because six straight characters wasn't interesting. And he wrote that character with Mifune's personality in mind.
All right. Well, I think it's that time. Final question, guys. So this is the 17th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. 17th greatest movie of all time. Do we think it deserves that spot? Should it be higher? Should it be lower? Should it be just where it's at? Gabe, what do you think?
In light of the narrative nature of this film and my allegiance to the fact that is an important component of filmmaking, I think I would probably want it to be a little bit higher.
Okay.
On this list.
Okay. All right. Cool. Derek, how about you?
That's a tough question for me to answer because I didn't study film.
Yeah.
I understand that there are a lot of very revolutionary tactics that Kurosawa employs in this film. As far as shooting, even a lot of plot devices that he uses that purportedly this film was the first or one of the first to use, or to use so effectively to the point that it has been mimicked many, many, many times, and they're now almost cliche in our movies. But there weren't movies that did that before this film. You know, the getting a ragtag bunch of people into your group and to kill the enemy, and the love between the the youngest guy and the girl of the town. And a lot of these things weren't really present in movies before that. And so I think as far as influence goes, I think it's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
Since I didn't study film, I don't know where it ranks as far as other films go. But
yeah.
As a kid and even as an adult, I love this film.
All right. You took the words right out of my mouth because I think it definitely deserves at least to be number 17 due to its influence, which is something we haven't really talked about. But a number of very famous American filmmakers have cited Kurosawa and this film as an influence.
Mm-hmm.
Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, you know. Mm-hmm. So that alone, I think, I think its influence is undeniable. It's such a well-regarded film among so many people. And in addition, I also wanted to briefly mention in the late spring episode of the podcast, I did a segment on gateway films, films that could possibly lead to a greater appreciation for filmmaking and may possibly get you into films. And I listed this film as one that would be good to start with for people who are maybe hesitant to watch foreign films because it is so accessible. All right, so I think fair to say, 17, definitely worthy of 17, possibly higher.
Could go higher, yeah. I think.
And I think also revitalized the samurai flick. The genre was considered dead until, or at least stagnant until this movie came out and was a huge smash. So for that, I think we can all be very grateful.
I'd say so.
All right. Second topic, I'd like to revisit a subject we've danced around on several occasions. What are movies for? Is gauging the quality of a movie possible? How do we tell a good movie from a bad movie? In previous episodes, Gabe has talked about how he thinks the primary purpose of a movie should be to entertain. This has always been a position that I've taken issue with, but we've never really had it out until now.
Dun dun dun!
I'm told Gabe has brought in a little mini dissertation on the subject. So, Gabe, I'm going to let you have the floor for a few minutes, and then afterwards we'll discuss. So without further ado, Gabe, take it away.
Okay, so I'm just going to talk about what I think movies are for and what I think what the nature of filmmaking is.
Okay.
So filmmaking, I think, is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And storytelling is something that naturally we enjoy, just as humans. It's one of the oldest things in recorded history. The Bible may have been handed down, you know, by word of mouth for several generations prior to anything being written down. The Greek tragedies, the mythology was often, you know, just spoken or sung to generation after generation. So storytelling is something that's very natural to man, to humans. And what storytelling is the imitation of actions. And so, you know, the actors imitate a samurai. And imitation is how we learn. And you see that in, you know, a little baby watching his dad or watching his parents. You know, the how you learn karate is by watching your sensei. You know, everything that we learn by imitation.
Mm-hmm.
And we naturally love to learn. Humans naturally enjoy learning. You know, even take the most disgruntled teenager in high school that purports to hate school and hate having to learn everything. You know, you can ask him about his favorite band or his favorite movie or favorite TV show, you know, and he'll go on for hours and hours of just this insatiable appetite for knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this natural love of learning that can enable us to enjoy even you know, depictions of tragedy or depictions of suffering, because we learn through all these things. And so what I think film is ultimately for is to teach us through means of entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically it.
Okay. So does a movie have to be entertaining to be good?
I think so, because if it's not entertaining, then it's not going to be captivating. It's not going to capture our attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not going to teach us anything. And when I use the term teach, I think I mean it in a very broad sort of way, not in the sort of, you know, sit down.
Right. It's not a lecture kind of thing.
It's not a lecture. You know, teach sort of, you know, experience, you know, and because like we see in many films, it's not necessarily that you are being taught something new. You've seen one rom-com, you've seen them all, you know, but we continue to see them again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very similar story, so it's not something new necessarily that we're learning or that is being taught to us.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I disagree with that thesis, because I do think, for me, movies are a means of enriching my life.
Yes.
That is, to me, I do learn something with every movie. That's the goal, is to learn something, is to shine a light on another facet of humanity, another part of being human. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is possible, or at least to a much lower degree, if you are not entertained
mm-hmm.
by it, if you are not engaged by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so we've all seen boring movies. And I couldn't, you know, people will say, you know, you'll talk to someone and they'll say, oh, but this and that and that, the other happened. And you'll think, I just didn't get that.
Yeah.
Because it didn't engage me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't understand that.
I guess my issue is that entertainment connotes pleasure. It connotes, it's like, I think of Gladiator. Are you not entertained? It can, like, it sets off to me, it gives an image of, like, releasing the pleasure centers in the basest portion of our brains. You know, like, I feel like engaged is a good word.
Okay.
Like, I feel like movies should engage you. And I don't necessarily think it needs to be a narrative to engage. Like, it doesn't need to have a strong narrative necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the movie that we're doing next week is Mirror, which doesn't have a very strong narrative. And in fact, I'm going to talk about movies that don't have a strong narrative, or any narrative, really. There are plenty of very, very interesting non-narratives that totally just expand your worldview. There's so many different things you can depict in a movie. So, It's interesting when you say entertainment, because I will totally admit, in my top five, my favorite movies of all time, I find them completely entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I love watching them. But to me, it seems too restrictive almost, you know?
Yeah, but again, like try to consider, are there any movies in your top 10 or top 25 or top 250, for example, that you would put there that do not entertain, or to use your word, engage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so to play around, you know, we can play around with the term,
mm-hmm.
what exactly that term should be, either entertainment, engagement, the film has to provide a catharsis of
mm-hmm.
emotion,
mm-hmm.
Some sort of a change in you. But the bottom line is, I think we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, we're getting into semantics here. Yeah,
yeah. I think we're talking about the same thing, that we need to experience that for a movie to be a rewarding endeavor.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things, if you look at it and really break down what a film is, what a story is, and how just on a very natural level, we enjoy learning,
mm-hmm.
that is the way that you can kind of understand why we can enjoy tales of tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch the end of Seven Samurai, and the last shot is four graves, you know, and but you still come away enjoying or being fulfilled by that movie experience.
Yeah.
You know, or you watch, you see like a beautiful painting of a sorrowful moment, you know, and often come around with like war.
Yeah.
You know, you see depictions of soldiers, you know, kneeling on the battlefield beside a fallen comrade, and they're great. You
right.
know, it's great art.
Right. But I wouldn't call it entertaining. Yeah. You
know? No. And so that's why we can try to find try to get at the heart of what it is. It's engaging, but it provides an emotional release.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's in that way that we can enjoy or be satisfied with these depictions of, you know, something tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Derek, as a non-movie person, I mean, you love movies, right?
I love movies.
You love
yes.
movies. But you don't, perhaps don't think about it in these terms very often.
No, this is going to be speaking from a peasant's point of view over here.
What do you look for in a movie? What is your...
Well, yeah, I like to be entertained, obviously. I like movies provide a diversion, if nothing else,
right.
From the obligations that you have in your life. You can watch a movie and not be obligated by anything, and it can take you away from the things that you have to do in your life and just entertain you for that, you know, brief 2 hour or 3.5 hour, being the case, period of time. And me not having studied film, but having moved to LA, talking to most people who have studied film all their life, and I realized that a lot of movies that I consider my favorite movies aren't considered great films. And that doesn't change the fact that it's a great film for me and that it entertains me. So for me, I mean, if it entertains me, then I'm satisfied with it. That doesn't mean it's a great film. It doesn't mean it's a superlative film. A movie like this, that like Seven Samurai, that entertains but also pushes the genre forward as far as techniques and plot elements and stuff like that, I think that will be considered more of an exemplary film, more of a superlative film. At the heart of it, though, I mean, I feel like if I'm entertained, then I'm happy. And if I'm entertained and the movie is revolutionary, then obviously it could be considered a better film.
To me, diverting, like creating a diversion, a diverting experience is a very, very low bar. Like Transformers is a very diverting move, you know.
No, but see, but that's the thing. If we're considering diversion in a specific way,
effective diversion,
exactly,
something that makes you forget that you have all these obligations. And if a movie isn't good enough, it won't divert you. It won't entertain you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like you watch. I was watching the most recent Spider-Man that was released, and I was not engaged by it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not an effective means of diversion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I understand what you're saying, but diversion, especially now, has sort of the connotation of just like, hey, I smack you upside the head, that's a diversion.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. like, well, that's a very different diversion than Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
Which has the ability to engage you, and is not a frivolous diversion. It has the ability to engage you for 3.5 hours and, you know, and be something powerful or an effective or a worthwhile diversion.
Yeah. So, but I want to make a distinction, because there are films like Seven Samurai that we could talk about for hours. We could talk about the sociopolitical ramifications of the whatever. We could go on. And there's a lot to unpack in that movie. But I can also be diverted by the Avengers. It's a very diverting, it's very, very entertaining.
Yeah, and those can be good or even great films.
Yeah.
The films that are obviously influential, and the same goes for music, I think, as being a different art form, but one that I relate to perhaps more than movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are musical artists that push genres forward, and then there are musical artists that don't do anything new, but they build off the building blocks that are already there. Mm-hmm. And we need that too, you know? I mean, everything can't be pushing the envelope. There should be movies that just take the building blocks that we have and make something entertaining out of it.
Yeah.
And a movie, like you said, like The Avengers, maybe that's all it is. But that's not to say it's not a good or even a great movie. Mm-hmm. If you watch it and you enjoy it and it brings you into that world... that's another thing I wanted to mention. A lot of movies that I consider my favorites are movies that kind of make me feel like I'm in that world,
mm-hmm.
and take me away from the mundane or the everyday world.
Mm-hmm.
And movies that have that ability to make you feel like you're there are great and effective. And even if it doesn't do anything revolutionary, that doesn't mean that it can't be a great film.
Sure, yeah. No, I completely agree. And I think... the impact of cinema that I feel no other art form can really create is, like, really make you feel like you're in a different world. But I also wanted to say, as Derek mentioned, there are movies that create a whole world, and that filmmaker's job is to effectively create an entire world that you can inhabit for the length of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like there are movies that shine a light on our world, that cast our world in a new light. And to me, a movie should not simply last the length of its runtime.
Mm.
A movie, for me, I take with me for days after watching. I like to mull things over.
That's exactly what they're often supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, is show you, is teach you something new, or,
mm-hmm.
or a new way of looking at life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a lot of times when I watch a movie and if you ask me if I liked it or how much I liked it right after the movie, I might, you know, say something, but it takes often a few days. Am I still thinking about this movie after a few days?
Mm-hmm.
And then if I am, that's a sign to me. It's a subconscious thing. But even after a few days, I'm still thinking about the characters, and then I realize I must have really liked that movie,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very effective diversion.
Right.
I just don't like that word. I feel like it's like it trivializes what we're doing, you know? And I feel like entertainment does as well. I feel like, to me, movie going and watching a movie can be such a profound experience,
mm-hmm.
A life-changing experience, that to me, entertainment doesn't encompass that. I think we agree on the basic principle that film should be engaging and that there should be some takeaway, or that it's great if there is some takeaway, if it does enrich your life in some way. But I think it's just a matter of the word entertainment, because I like films to be challenging. Sometimes you walk away from a movie and you're like, I don't know if I liked that at all. And then you come away a few weeks later, you're like, you know what? I'm still thinking about that. Maybe I did like it. Maybe I appreciate it now more than I did when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
It might be
appreciation rather than being entertained by it.
Yeah.
Those are two different, you know, qualities, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And there are films, like, you watch it once, you're like, I never need to see that again.
Mm-hmm. But you still liked it, maybe.
You like it, you appreciate it, but... you wouldn't say it was entertaining, you know.
Right.
There are certain things, like, I'm glad I watched it. Don't need to see that again.
Mm.
So, but was there anything else on the subject? All right, so I guess we've settled that. Never need to talk about it again. Let's finish this thing off on a positive note. Gabe, send some good vibes my way. Talk to me about one piece of culture that you've been digging lately.
I have been enjoying the Script Notes podcast
with
John August and Craig Mazin. You can find it on iTunes or on johnaugust.com. And I was struck recently by a quote from Craig Mason. So he says, "Stories are often here to entice us to be brave enough to change. The antagonist in a film will not be willing to change, but the protagonist will be willing to change."
Interesting. All right. Well, listen up, all you aspiring screenwriters out there. Script Notes Podcast. Derek, how about you?
Well, I've been into Yelp lately.
All right.
And yeah, so when I was in Japan, I learned a lot about food. And they have a similar site, similar to Yelp. And the Japanese critics are often a lot harsher than American critics, I find, when it comes to food. And reading so much about that really, I think, I feel it honed my sense of what food should be. 'Cause when I moved to Japan, I didn't care about food. And when I came back from Japan after 6 years, my thoughts on what food should be were totally different. And coming here, I've found this site called Yelp, which apparently most people use. And I spent some time just lurking on it. And then just recently I decided, maybe I'll try to write a little bit. And I did this foray into writing a few reviews. And I don't know if anyone's reading them or what, but but it's fun. And I like it.
All right. Cool. I think it's so cool that, like, come back from Japan and there's this very popular site and it's like totally new to you. Mm-hmm. It's like,
I had
Yelp.
Never even heard of it. No, I had been away for so long.
All right. All right. Well, my final note of positivity is I recently came upon a series of posts on a film blog called The Film Experience. And the series is A Year with Kate. And it's to sum it up, it's a woman named Anne Marie Kelly is going through Katharine Hepburn's entire filmography, film by film, and writing an essay about every single one. And it's just, it's all the good ones, the bad ones, and the ugly. And there's a little bit of all three. And she's only about halfway through at this point. So there's more good, there's more great to come. And there's also a little bit of ugly towards the end. But anyway, it just...
Sorry, did you say Audrey or Kate?
Kate Hepburn.
Okay.
Katharine Hepburn.
Okay.
Maybe I should just do the rest of the podcast with this advice.
Well, go ahead. We're almost done.
Yeah.
I was going to do all my lines in Japanese, but
you decided against
yeah.
it.
I was on the way here.
We can't put subtitles on a podcast.
All right. Well... Anyway, it seems like such a fun project, and it got me thinking about maybe I should do something like that, except I think my girl's always been Betty Davis, but I love Kate as well. So, and it's also good. I feel like the author is someone who is approximately my age, and it's so rare to find people who are, again, around that age range. And by my age, I mean under 60, who still love... The golden age, the screen sirens of the golden age. So it's always very heartening to see that for me. So.
I think people listening are going to have a very hard time discerning what age you feel you are.
Well, that's the thing, is that I can only usually relate to people who are older because I have these sort of, my tastes skew a little bit older. But so that was heartening.
Maybe you found a kindred spirit.
Maybe I did.
Maybe
I'd like to think so. Maybe I will. Maybe I will. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Come tell us where you stand on our movies. Come tell us where you stand on our movies as entertainment debate on our website, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But above all else, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. On our next show, we're going to discuss a slightly less accessible film, but a great one nonetheless. We're going to talk about the 18th greatest movie of all time, Andrei Tarkovsky's Mirror. If you haven't seen it yet, make sure to check it out. In the meantime, Derek, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, pleasure as always.
Thank you, thank you.
All right, sayonara.
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 All right, who's going to steal me a musket?